From the Old City, a practical Torah commentary by Gutman Lodge. The Book of Leviticus, Sefer Vayikra. Leviticus 14, Matsura. Washing is washing. This week we read more about the physical and spiritual uncleanliness and their remedies. One of the steps required to cleanse oneself is to wash or bathe in water. Today it seems completely obvious that an unclean person should wash. But actually this fact was not known to the medical world until quite recently, just some 100 years ago. When the plagues ravaged Europe and the Jewish villages survived to a much greater extent than the surrounding Gentile villages, people thought the Jews were witches. But actually, we survived because we washed after touching an unclean thing. We can learn about the nature of uncleanliness by the way we wash our hands. When we wash before eating bread, we fill the cup with water and pour it over our right hand first, 1, 2, 3 times. Some say 2 times is enough. Then we pour the water on the left hand 3 times. However, when we wash for uncleanliness, such as upon waking from sleep, using the restroom, bleeding or such, then we wash quite differently. For this type of washing, we pour the water on the right hand 1 time, then we pour it on the left hand 1 time, then back to the right, then back to the left, and so on until we have washed each hand 3 times. Why should we go through all the trouble of switching the cup back and forth? After all, washing is washing. When we are washing for bread, the main intent is to elevate our hands in spirituality. It is also a cleansing, but its main function is to be a reminder of the priest who would wash before eating their portion of the sacrifices and tithes. In this case, we simply continue washing each hand until it is clean. The reason we wash 3 times is as follows. The first rinse washes away the uncleanliness. The second rinse washes away the water that touched the uncleanliness. And the third rinse washes away any unclean water that we might have missed. However, when we are washing for a more severe uncleanliness, it is as if we have acid on our hands. If we would continue to pour water on the same hand 2 or 3 times, the other hand would be burning by then. So the quickest way to rid ourselves of this acid is to rinse one hand and then quickly rinse the other hand, and then back and continue like that until the acid is gone. Even the smallest tradition that we have maintained throughout the ages comes with many levels of understanding. They are precious and must be guarded. As we do them time and time again, a greater appreciation of their importance should dawn. This week's portion teaches us the laws of purification. The unclean person described here suffered from a disease that manifested on his skin. Our sages explain that this disease is a physical manifestation of a spiritual disease that was brought about mostly from the sin of evil gossip. The affected person is exiled out of the camp and suffers great humiliation as a result of his sin. Since his sin of gossip humiliated the person he sinned against, he too must be humiliated. We are told that in order to know God, we must be humble, and that Moshe was the most humble of all people. But is this humility that the plagued person suffers the same type of humility that we are to strive for? No, not at all. The humility the plagued person suffers is the result of his sin. He is embarrassed because of what he did, and as a result of the treatment he receives, he realizes how low he is. This is his humility. The humility we are to strive for is the result of our realizing just how small we are in comparison to our Creator. Look at your precious body. Is there anything dearer to you than your body? If you would look at that very body of yours with a microscope, you would see that it's really zillions of tiny, tiny molecules and mostly empty space. In fact, scientists claim that the human body is 99.9% empty space. According to the Torah, they are very close, but not quite right. When we magnify the molecules we are made of, we see that they are actually zillions of atoms and mostly empty space. Here, too, science says that each atom is really made up of 99.9% empty space. Look deeper at the atoms. You'll see gluons, quarks, and other tiny particles. When we magnify them, we find that they, too, are made up of billions and billions of even tinier particles and even more vast empty space. Soon, we find absolutely nothing at all. That's right. Your entire body, that physical thing you think you are, is right now being made out of nothing. All of creation is like this. God not only created the universe out of nothing, but he continues to do so at every moment. Right this second, he is forming this entire complex universe out of no pre-existing matter. It is simply creation of something from nothing. Yesh me'ayin. So what is so great about you anyway, that you could possibly be arrogant? You're made out of nothing. This is an exercise in humility. We can come to humility from many directions. Ask yourself if what you have accomplished in all your years was as good as you could have done had you really tried hard. Did you do all that you could have? Ask yourself, what are you going to take with you when you leave this world? How important are you? Such thinking will bring you to the humility that we seek. Humility does not have to come from sin. It can come from the plain, humble facts. Lunch. I was praying outside by the kotel early one Shabbat morning when a very large insect flew over and stopped just a few yards in front of me. It was hovering in the air at eye level, completely still. It was nicely colored, some gold and brown. I was taken by the way it froze there, seemingly not moving up or down at all, just hanging out motionless. I began to wonder, how is it that those insect molecules are able to float perfectly still in midair? Its wings must have been flapping fiercely, but I could not see them. Just this large, perfectly still, flat, suspended bug. I thought not to waste my time thinking about and watching such a sight during prayer, but the suspended bug was just so fascinating. How does nature work it out that such a heavy thing could stand there, silent, stock still in the air? I wondered what its consciousness might have been right then. What was it thinking as it perched there, 4 or 5 feet off the ground? I was staring at the floating insect, trying to come close to understanding what it really was. My eyes were fixed, almost glued on to that wonder, when all of a sudden a large black blur swept fiercely into view. It came racing across the sky, zooming in from the far left corner of my left eye, streaking in front of me, onto and out of the far right corner of my right eye, one swift swoop, immediately out of sight. Zoom. The floating insect instantly disappeared, vanished. The black blur turned out to be a large, hungry bird. All that majesty, all that mystery floating in the air, that space station with all its structure that supported a living being that could actually fly, standing fixed to one place, stock still, hovering while setting its direction, calculating its next move. It was gone. It was lunch for something bigger, something that flies faster, with a greater vision that can spot a bug from a block away, something hungry, naturally sweeping the sky, snatching, gulping, so it can keep doing what it was programmed to do. Quietly somewhere, a large gray cat watches the big black bird, waiting to see where it might land, its steel eyes anticipating. And us? What is around the corner waiting to eat us? Are we any more sturdy than that bug? What are we? Nothing to brag about. Leviticus 16, Achrei. Send that animal to the wilderness. In this week's portion of the Torah, the details of the Yom Kippur service are explained. This is the day set aside for national atonement and, fittingly, is considered the most holy and serious day of the year. Besides the intricate and detailed instructions regarding the priestly garments and service that we are accustomed to seeing in the Torah, this portion also describes what must be the most unusual sacrifice in the entire Torah. The high priest is commanded to take two similar he-goats, one of which is to become a sin offering for the entire nation and is to be offered up on the altar, and the other one, which is to be the bearer of all the people's sins, is to be taken out into the wilderness and pushed over a cliff. What are we to learn from this unusual service? After concluding the instructions for the Yom Kippur service, the Torah details a number of transgressions and sternly warns us not to do them. Why, almost immediately after concluding the Yom Kippur instructions, does the Torah warn us not to consume blood? Who would want to do such a thing? Then the Torah instructs that when we slaughter an animal, we are to pour out its blood on the ground and cover it with earth. Why must we do this? Next comes a long list of forbidden sexual relationships, some of which are quite shocking. We are warned not to have sexual relations with close relatives, such as our father, mother, stepmother, sister, grandchildren, and the list goes on and on. Who would ever think to do such things? And why are they listed on the holiest day of the year? In fact, to this day we read about these transgressions on Yom Kippur. Surely on this day, when we are dedicated to the highest values man can attain, we do not need to be warned about such gross acts. If we are to be warned, let us hear of sins that might be appropriate to this high status, such as do not be jealous of your fellow, or be careful not to judge before getting all the facts. But instead we are warned about these vulgar acts on such a holy day. Why? We are to see from the prohibitions listed what we are to learn from the sacrifices themselves. The he-goat that goes on the altar is called a sacrifice to God, and the other he-goat is called the he-goat that is sent to the wilderness. With our sacrifices, we are acting out our promise. The animal that goes on the altar stands for our animal inclination that we are subjugating to God. This means that we're going to direct all of our permitted animal deeds to the service of God. There is a way to elevate our low desires and to use those very animal desires in the service of God. Take eating, for example. Rather than eating as an animal eats by simply tearing its prey and drinking its blood, we're going to offer our food on the altar. This means that the food is to be permissible, and that we bless and thank the one who gives it to us. Then we dedicate the energy that comes from eating that food to doing holy acts. This intention elevates common eating, which is simply satisfying an animal need, and turns it into a holy act. The same thing goes for sexual relations. The Torah lists those gross sexual transgressions here to show us that we are not mere animals. Animals mate with any available animal without regard for relationships. Such behavior is solely animal instinct. But we are to elevate this act. We are to marry in purity and holiness and engage in sexual behavior in a pure and holy way. We are to conform to the Torah's list of permissible mates and are forbidden to act like mere animals. Those other animal inclinations within us that could lead us to tear an animal's limb and to eat it with its blood, or have sexual relationships with close relatives, are to be taken out into the wilderness and pushed over a cliff. The One and Many. It was during the Yom Kippur service that the high priest was to go into the Holy of Holies, and Hashem said, "In a cloud I will appear upon the ark cover." Aaron, the high priest, would bring the required sacrifices, and he would atone for the people's sins. This is why Yom Kippur is called the Day of Atonement. In Hebrew and in English, the name of the day refers to similar concepts, such as appease, redeem, amend, and such. The Hebrew has an additional meaning that the English does not have, and the English has a meaning that is not readily seen in the Hebrew. The Hebrew word Kippur comes from the root to cover, and this is what the day does. It covers over our sins. Also, Hashem would appear in a cloud above the ark cover, and his presence would cover the cover. In English, the further meaning is found in the word atone, which is spelled at one. When there is a sin that is not forgiven, there's friction, unrest. When there is forgiveness, the friction ceases and the peaceful feeling of experiencing all as one can return. When the high priest would sprinkle the blood of the sacrifice upon the altar, he would count in a most unusual way. He had to sprinkle it 7 times, and each time he would say the number of that count. The sages tell us that he counted this way so he would not forget. But the way he counted also had a deeper meaning. He counted 1, 1 and 2, 1 and 3, 1 and 4, 1 and 5, 1 and 6, 1 and 7. If the sole reason for counting was not to forget which sprinkle he was sprinkling, he could have simply counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. But by counting this way, we see the one of atonement. One refers to all, one and two. The two refers to the two found in the physical perspective of the one. For instance, you and I are two, one and three. This says that all is one and is also three. For instance, you, me, and it, one and four. Again, the one is always one, even though there are certainly four and five and six and seven and so on. The high priest was atoning for the many by bringing them back to the peace that comes from recognizing the one. Leviticus 19, Kedoshim, My sanctuary shall you revere. In this week's portion of the Torah, we are told, My Shabbats shall you observe, and my sanctuary shall you revere. I am Hashem. What, if anything, do Shabbat and a sanctuary have in common? Why are we instructed about these two in the same sentence? Shabbat frames holiness in time, and a sanctuary frames holiness in space. As far as the average person can tell, one day or the next feels the same. That is, unless we do something to make that day feel special. If we were to awaken from a long coma, we would not be able to tell what day of the week it was unless we saw people doing something that was done only on a specific day. Although mystically Shabbat has a different feeling than the other days of the week, to the average person, one day feels just like the next. Because of this, we have to do holy things on Shabbat in order to feel the holiness of the day. As it says, My Shabbats shall you observe. By observing Shabbat, we will reap the spiritual benefits of the holy day. To the average person, if it were not for the furnishings, one room would feel just like another. However, when we do special things in that room or furnish it in a special way, then we can feel something special there. Today's sanctuaries are the places where we gather to pray. In order to experience the holiness of Shabbat, all we have to do is to observe its details. Just by doing what the Torah tells us to do on this day, we will automatically reap the benefits of the holy day. But to reap the benefits of a holy place, we must do more than merely observe the rules of behavior there. We must revere that place. Revere means to be in awe. If when we enter our holy places we would say, How full of awe is this place, and try to sense a deep feeling of respect while we are there, we will experience the holiness of the place. For instance, if one recognizes the holiness of a place of prayer, he would not walk inside with a burning cigarette in his hand. He would never even think to talk on his telephone there, but would be careful to turn it off before he entered. A spiritually sensitive person would not speak of profane subjects in a synagogue, but without paying attention to the unique atmosphere of the place, there would be no reason to maintain this level of respect. Both Shabbat and a sanctuary can give us the experience of holiness. yet they can give us this feeling only up to the amount of effort we put into them. Forbidden mixtures. In this week's portion of the Torah, there are many commandments given. Some, such as not to commit perversions in weights and measures, are quite logical. Obviously, it's wrong to cheat in business, but some of the laws listed in this portion are apparently so illogical that they defy man's ability to understand them. In fact, the sages tell us that this type of law, called a chok, has no logical reason. The most commonly singled out law for its complete illogic is the law dealing with forbidden mixtures. There are four basic types of forbidden mixtures: mixture of seeds, when planting plants, mixture of orchards, fruit trees, mixtures in species, when breeding animals, and mixtures of linen and flax, garments. The Torah warns us that such mixtures sap the strength from the individual species. What could these laws possibly be teaching us today? Here the Torah is using a common Talmudic principle called all the more so, kal vachomer. When we look, we see that each of these forbidden mixtures points back to us. For instance, the seeds of a garden are like a man's own seed. The fruit of a tree is its offspring. A man is likened to a tree of the field, and fittingly, our children are called our fruit. Our animals are not merely our physical animals, but also our spiritual animals and our animal inclinations. And our garments are our deeds. Now to apply the all the more so principle. If I am not to mix my vegetable seeds, because this will drain the strength of each plant, and if I'm not to mix my fruit trees, as this will weaken the fruit of my trees, and if I'm not to mix my animals, as this will produce weakened livestock, and if I'm not to mix my garments, that are also my deeds, then surely all the more so, I am not to mix my actual offspring, my children, my family. Jews are commanded to marry only Jews and raise Jewish families to maintain a healthy, vibrant Jewish people in the world. Without doubt, this is the greatest test facing the Jewish nation today, as the vast majority of Jews around the world intermarry. Leviticus 21, Amor. Counting the all in all. This week's portion of the Torah lists many of the requirements of purity that apply to the priest and to the sacrifices. These are followed by the festival calendar where the holidays are described. Beginning with the second night of Pesach, Passover, there begins a 50-day period of spiritual purification. During this time, we count each day and week that leads up to the bringing of the two loaves made from the new crop of wheat. They were brought upon the completion of this 50-day, 7-week period on the holiday of Shavuos, which means weeks. This is the holiday when we celebrate the receiving of the Torah. These 50 days reflect the 50 days it took the Jewish people to travel from Egypt to Mount Sinai in order to receive the Torah. Surely they could have arrived at Mount Sinai sooner, but more time was required for them to shed the spiritual uncleanliness that came upon them from having lived in a land of idolatry and perversion for so many years. Each day they moved further away from Egypt and came closer to Mount Sinai, elevated and purified them. Each day they left behind an additional level of impurity and attained a higher level of spirituality, until the 50th day when they were pure enough to receive the Torah. Today we reenact this process as we count the Omer. This is done during the 50-day period leading up to Shavuos. The Omer was the sheaf of new barley grain that was brought up to the temple to be offered as a meal offering on the second day of Pesach. The two loaves that were brought upon the completion of the counting of the Omer on Shavuos were made out of wheat. This reflects the elevation process of the barley. The barley offered at the beginning of the counting is considered to be animal food, while the wheat that was brought upon the completion of the counting is human food. Each night we count these 50 days, we also recognize which particular spiritual characteristic is being rectified. These characteristics can also be referred to as graded emanations, vessels, or molds in which all creation is formed. They are called the Ten Sefirot. Their function is to guide the creation in general and the Jewish people in particular in order to bring the entire creation to its greatest potential. Of these ten spiritual characteristics with which God creates the universe, the seven lower ones are manifested in a revealed way. It is these seven and combinations of them that we mention each night as we count the Omer. The names of the Sefirot are an attempt to label things that are too subtle for the mind to comprehend. The seven lower Sefirot are called kindness or benevolence, strength or to prevail, beauty or mercy, victory or permanence, glory or majesty, foundation or establishment, and kingship or dominion. Many of these names and their very definitions overlap so much that at times they are interchangeable. We continue counting each night according to the order until we have rectified the seven lower emanations and all of their paired combinations. For instance, one night we rectify kindness that is in strength, and on another night we rectify strength that is in kindness. We must ask ourselves, what is the nature of each night's particular emanation? For instance, on the appropriate night, we should try to understand what the kindness in strength is that we are rectifying that day. Then, at its particular time, we must try to understand what is the strength that is in kindness. There is no single metaphor that explains these emanations and their combinations, but rather we are free to delve into our own thinking and try to discover ideas that fit those particular characteristics. One way to explain strength and kindness is to see what is happening when a father yells at his young child. His urgency is very strict, it's strong, but he is doing this out of kindness. However, when the father gives his child a new computer, his action appears to be entirely kind, but his underlying motive is really the strength of training his son. This, then, is an act of kindness and strength. All of the emanations and their combinations can be identified and understood in the same way. The greatest mistake people make regarding these ten emanations is thinking that they are like a ladder, with one end being in one sefirot location and the next sefirot at another location. Rather, we must know that all ten are in the same place at the same time. Use a sweater as an example. One could say that it is wool. Another might say that it is a sweater, while a third could say that it is a garment. Another will say that it's molecules, and another will say that it's fibers, and so on. All of these definitions are correct. Each is addressing a different aspect or perspective of the sweater, but all of these aspects are manifesting in the same place at the same time. If all these emanations are in all things at all times, what is being taught by one day saying kindness that is in strength, and then another day turning it around and saying strength that is in kindness? When we refer to the aspect of kindness that is in strength, we are pointing to the perspective when kindness is most obvious, but the underlying essential aspect is strength. When we refer to strength that is in kindness, we are seeing strength as the apparent purpose for the act, but the true, deeper underlying reason is its kindness. Each act and each thing in creation contains all ten emanations. More holidays. After discussing the laws of the priest, the sacrifices, and then the holidays, this week's portion discusses the menorah and the showbread. We could make a strong argument here that with these two subjects, the Torah is also hinting to the rabbinical holidays that were to come many years after the Torah was written. Beside the major Torah-derived holidays, we also have two major holidays that come to us solely from the rabbis, Hanukkah and Purim. In fact, much of what we do today has its source in rabbinical laws and not directly from the Torah itself. But since the rabbis have been given this authority from the Torah itself, it is as if it is coming directly from the Torah. The menorah can be seen to be an obvious reference to the holiday of Hanukkah, since the entire holiday relates to the menorah. The showbread can be seen to be a hint to the holiday of Purim. Although there are a number of specific mitzvahs we do on Purim, the main idea of the holiday is to remember what Amalek did to the Jewish people and to celebrate our having overcome that threat by enjoying a large meal. The showbread were 12 loaves of bread. These loaves were placed on a special table to be eventually divided among the priests. Frankincense was sprinkled on them as a remembrance. Having many loaves of bread on the table as a remembrance certainly can be seen as a hint to the celebration of Purim. A question that arises from this discussion is, what is the role of the rabbis today? Throughout the ages, many types of rabbis have come along and started movements that garnered great numbers of Jews. This is not a new phenomenon. All the way back to our time in the wilderness, and certainly in the temple days, spin-offs to Torah Judaism and cults have been formed. In our day, we see that the majority of Jews follow either no Jewish tradition at all or the Reform movement. There are many Jewish groups who claim to be the legitimate heirs of the Torah that was given to us on Mount Sinai. Besides the Reform, there are the Conservative, Reconstructionist, New Age, Jewish Renewal, Alternative, Pluralist, and so on. So how can we tell which is right? Which of the so-called rabbis or lay leaders should we follow? The answer is really quite simple. Which stream of Judaism guarantees that there will be a Jewish people in the future? Today, only the Orthodox tradition has a track record of Jewish survival. Even the conservative, who until recently have always claimed to be a Torah observant movement, have now permitted homosexual marriages. Certainly this movement will not guarantee a Jewish population. The Reform rabbis are officiating at mixed marriages, and the third generation secular are experiencing an astonishing 95% rate of intermarriage. Today in California, 65% of secular marriages end in divorce, while somewhere between 6 to 17%, depending on the community, of Torah observant marriages fail and end divorce. If there were no other reason than this for following the Torah, it would be enough. Leviticus 25, Bahar. 7 times 7. This week's portion of the Torah discusses the seventh year release, the Shemitah, and the 7 years times 7 years cycle that brings an even greater release, the 50th year, the Jubilee. First, we should ask, what is so special about the number 7? Number 1, there are 7 days in a week. Since more than 7 begins a new week, the number 7 expresses completion. 2, the seventh day of the week is the Shabbat, when Jews are commanded to rest. Both the Jew and his household are released from work on this day. 3. The infant male is brought by his parents to be circumcised on the day after he completes his seventh day. 4. During the seventh year release, the land in Israel must rest. All working of the land is strictly forbidden throughout this entire year. Also in this year, debts are to be forgiven. 5. The Torah commands that the Jewish slaves were to be freed after 6 years of servitude, in their seventh year. They were freed without having to pay anything more to their master than the 6 years that they had already served. They went free, that is, unless they said that they liked slavery and wanted to remain as slaves. In such a case, the master would make a hole in the ear and they would serve as slaves forever. As it turns out, this forever actually means until the 7 years times 7 years of the Jewish cycle were complete. The 50th year was the Jubilee year, and the grand release was announced. On Yom Kippur of the Jubilee year, the ram's horn was sounded, and all the Jewish slaves were free to return to their families. Also in the Jubilee year, the land that the individual tribes inherited, which had subsequently been sold, returned to its tribal owner. Certainly all these laws were physically observed. In the Jubilee year, the slaves actually went free. Debts were truly forgiven. The land that had been sold was physically returned to its original owner. All of the details of the seventh day, seventh year, and the seven times 7 years were faithfully fulfilled. But what are we, who are not slaves and not indebted, to learn from all this? We live in a world where there is no known ancestral tribal land ownership. Except for the rare few, most debts are not being forgiven. Most lenders today take precautions to guarantee payment even in the Shemitah year. We do not have literal slaves with bored ears. It might seem that there is nothing to learn from these Torah teachings today. Therefore, are these teachings no longer applicable since we do not have the Jubilee? All of these sevens that we just discussed have an underlying common denominator that is just as applicable today as it was in the actual Jubilee year. When the literal perspective is no longer applicable, we must not think that the other perspectives are also nullified. For example, 1. All of these cycles point to completion and release. 2. With the completion of the work week, the Jew is released from his work and must rest. 3. The seventh year shows that even the physical land must rest. Even the inanimate land must be released from its labor. Debts are to be released. 4. The Jubilee year shows that even slaves who are slaves forever will be released and returned to their families. Even the land that was sold to a stranger will be released and returned. What is the primary lesson of these examples of completion of a cycle and the subsequent release? The primary lesson is, in this world, we are just tenants. The ultimate release. Seeing these cycles should prepare us for the truly grand release, the release that is coming when the slave will be set free and will return to the place from where he came. The soul, which we really are, is being held in the body much like a master holds his slave. The soul was sent here into this world against its will, and it was sent to work the land, to improve it, and to make it a better place for his master. When the Torah discusses the commandment to let the land of Israel rest, and that it may not be sold forever, God tells us in the Torah that we are but sojourners and residents with God. Sojourners and residents are not the landlords. They do not own the ground they are standing on. They are only here with their owner's permission. A sojourner, a ger, is a stranger, a foreigner. To be a resident, yeshuvim, means you merely sit down, stay, or inhabit. As usual, the Torah is speaking at many depths. At the superficial perspective, God is telling us that since He brought us out of slavery, we are really His slaves now. And since He gave us this land that we are dwelling on, we are not its owners. He can tell us what He wants us to do with His land. But at a much deeper perspective, we see here that the Torah is telling us that just like the land must go back to its original owner, so will our own personal portion of land, our bodies, go back to its original owner. It is surely going back to the place it came from, back to the earth. Our bodies are merely allowed to sit on the land, having been raised up and formed into humans, for a while. Our bodies are the actual land we live on. We associate with our body so much that often we make the mistake of thinking that we are the body. But when the grand release comes, these bodies, this land we walk on, will return to its owner, back to the ground from where it came, and our souls will return to their source. And even more mystically, our very being, what we believe ourselves to be, our souls are also merely temporary beings. The souls, too, are tenants temporarily enjoying individual identity as souls. Not only are they temporarily housed as residents in the body, but ultimately their individual identity as souls will cease and they will return to their true owner. our souls will also cease to be seemingly independent entities when they return to the One from where they were apportioned. The soul is a veritable portion of God on high. The distinction between God on high and the soul is the soul's characteristic as a portion. When the soul's journey is over, its identity as a soul will cease. You, your body, and even your soul are merely tenants here, and not the boss you would like to think you are. Seeing the 7-day, 7-year, and 7x7-year releases throughout our lifetimes, and learning about them today, must remind us of the grand release that is surely coming. This should lead us to use our opportunity here more wisely. Then someday, God willing soon, the great ram's horn will physically sound, announcing that the Mashiach has come. Then, with the resurrection of the dead, even death itself will be released. As with most mystical teachings in the Torah, there are differences of opinions on the subject of souls. There is a strong opinion that states that the souls will exist forever as souls in the world to come. The opinion cited above that I just mentioned holds that ultimately even the world to come will revert back to the One as it was before creation began. The other school argues, if it goes back to what it was, then what was the purpose of it? The above cited school would answer, for the gorgeous joy of it. Leviticus 26:3. Bahukosai, our leftovers. This week's portion of the Torah speaks of the blessings that we receive when we treasure God's commandments and the horrible results that come when we do not. When we follow God's Torah, He will walk within us. He will be our God, and we will be His people. These blessings and curses are not random results of God's whims. They are the direct results of our specific actions. For instance, when we follow His ways, He turns His attention to us. As we turn our attention to Him, He does the same to us. When we follow the Torah, He walks within us. This means that when we walk with His Torah within us, He walks within us. Torah is likened to rain because it comes from the heavens and sustains life. When we fill our land with words of Torah, this act itself prompts the rains to come. When we bring upon ourselves the yoke of Torah, we break the yoke of slavery. Torah scholars increase peace in the world. As Torah scholars increase in our land, so does the peace between Hashem and us. There will be peace in our dealings with each other, and there will even be peace between us and our enemies. His blessings come according to our actions, portion for portion. And what does the Torah say will be the result of ignoring His words? The same rule applies. God says, then I will do the same to you. If we refuse to be His people, we will simply cease to be a people. As we surely see today, the land of your foes will devour you. If this does not come from war, then surely it will come from assimilation and intermarriage. After listing the terrible results that come from turning away, God speaks of the survivors among you. These devastations were mentioned here as a warning to try to prevent them from ever happening. God was addressing all of us before any of us were lost. He spoke of our survivors, showing that the ones who were not to survive and the ones who were to survive were being spoken to as a single whole. Our sinners were to be lost, and our survivors were to live on. Since He considered both of these groups as ours, this shows that He considers both the survivors and those who will not survive to be one. The practical result of this is, not only are we responsible for ourselves and our families, but since we are all one, we are also responsible for each other, including those who do not survive. In fact, when we help our fellow Jews, we are really helping ourselves. Thereisone.com